This is Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Dave Wyman and Bob Stelton.
Welcome, everybody. It's Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle. Another abbreviated edition of the program, but we don't mind after a Mariners win. Mariners win, okay, you can take part of our show. If you lose, you got to give it back. That's how it should work. But they were able to squeeze out one win in Houston. Should have been two. Should have gotten the game last night. Very frustrating last night to watch that smug little boy Bregman hit the ball over the fence, and he did it again today. And Altuve did it. And as I tweeted out, I think I've had enough of the little fella. Had enough of them.
I still love Altuve.
Yeah, I don't love him as much as I used to.
Yeah,
I appreciate who he is and what he's accomplished. I have an appreciation for him, but they're tainted. They're tainted in my eyes.
Well, especially he was the one that was like, don't rip my shirt off when he's coming to home plate. So, yeah, that was pretty damning. That today was great, right? I just was like, they should have had it last night. I mean, I was sitting there watching that.
Right there with you.
And then I caught up finally to where you guys were, and because I was behind. I'm like, don't tell me the score.
Yeah.
Oh, man, that was frustrating. And I mean, there was a lot of great moments in that game, you know. But, man, Sadler, he put two on the bottom of the six, gets out of it. You saw Castillo get him. Taro with a double. You know, it was just, I mean, there's lots to like, but – man, I wrote down some bad words here in front of
from last night's
in
game
in front of Bregman.
Oh,
of all people,
so punchable that face. And most of it goes back to when he was being asked about them cheating. Remember when he was kind of smirking and like, oh, I guess we're sorry, kind of attitude, like big deal. You know, it was just like, okay, alrighty, pal. And then you got Correa on the other side who's whining about, oh, it's been enough already, enough. I'm thinking, at that point, you hadn't been in front of an opposing fan base. What do you mean enough? You stop it. Stop crying. So, yeah, they're an unlikable bunch. Yeah. I hate the Astros. I know you got the A's as number one. Astros are still number one with me.
Yeah. Have you ever seen Old School?
Oh, yeah.
Remember when he comes home and his girlfriend has other people there for a sexual
encounter? Andy Dick is the teacher there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so he's talking to her, and then she's like, smoking a cigarette, and she's like, well, I'm sorry.
You're talking about the opening scene. Yeah. That one. I thought you were talking about when
she's like enjoying her cigarette, like, I'm sorry. Like, that's how Bregman was. That's what it reminded me of. I mean, he was like, well, you know, I mean, I guess we got away with it for a while, but
you know what he was
sorry.
Like, Dave? It was like, I'm sorry you feel that way.
Oh, that's
yeah.
That's a killer.
Nobody likes to hear that.
Nobody
Dave,
wants
in
to hear
scenario.
That.
Ever. I'm sorry that that's how you felt about things.
Right.
I'm not sorry about it. I'm just sorry you feel that way.
Yeah, and also, don't feel sorry for me.
Yeah. Don't you dare.
It's condescending.
It's very,
very condescending.
Very condescending, Dave. I can tell you this firsthand. I don't like it.
I wish we could reveal some things right now, but Bob and I just had this conversation, so
yeah.
And it relates to Bregman perfectly, but that's just who the Houston Astros are. But for them to be that tight in that game last night, and then getting the win today, you look at their lineup, they're just monsters, man.
I mean, they are.
You look at Brantley and Altuve and Gurriel. I mean, they just, and you were pointing this out the other day, that the number of hitters they have over 250 versus the number of hitters over 250 the Mariners have.
Yeah.
And they find a way to hang with them.
They've got one person in their lineup that's hitting below 200, and it's their catcher.
Yeah.
And he's a great catcher, great defensive catcher. So that's one of those things that there's the trade-off. Like, all right, we're going to take what he brings behind the plate. Sort of like you had with Zunino. You know, a guy can hit. He's got some pop. We're going to live with what he does or doesn't do at the plate because of what he brings behind the plate. Whereas the Mariners, I was going through it the other night, all the players they have hitting under 200 in their lineup, whether it's, you know, and some of it makes sense. They're young guys, rookies, and Cal Raleigh, who looks completely lost. Kelnick is starting to find it a little bit, but he's still under 200. Dylan Moore, I love the guy. I love what he brings. I love his speed. I love his versatility. But, man, what a disappointing season at the plate. He's hitting under 200, I think. Who was the other one out there? Marmolejos, who came up with a big hit. So, you know, guys that are struggling, though, have found their spots. to come up with big moments. And we just brought up Kelnick, and he had a huge moment in the seventh inning.
First pitch to Kelnick. Swing, and it's lifted deep out to left center field. Back to the warning track. Myers is there, and it bangs off the wall. France is in. Toro is rounding. He is on his way home. Toro scores standing. Jared Kelnick, first pitch swinging, has tied this game up as he blasts one off the wall in left center field. He's in at second, and this game is even at four with two outs in the seventh inning.
Huge moment for him. He's, you know, he had another bases loaded experience yesterday that didn't go well, and I saw a lot of frustration on my, because I tweeted out something along the lines of Toro came up with a hit, and I said I've just been conditioned to expect any time he steps up to the plate he's going to come up with a hit,
Toro,
right?
Yeah.
You know, just singing his praises. And what was funny is a lot of people were like, yeah, man, he's been great. But there was a number of responses, unlike Kelnick, yeah, just like that, except it's opposite for Kelnick. I mean, just one after another, and I'm like, wow, people are really frustrated with this kid. So good to see that moment for him.
How about, and also last night, the thing in center field. And look, yeah. Blauer's pointed it out. Center fielder has
center fielder is your general, as is your shortstop on the infield. You defer to them
right. If
they call you off. And it looked like he was calling off Bowers. The thing I'm wondering about that play is why did he not see where Bowers was at? He was basically camping under what would have been a really routine fly ball. And he came running all the way over from center field to left center to bang into it. I didn't understand. He must have lost sight of where Bowers was, because I don't know why he felt like he needed to run as far as he did to make that play when the left fielder standing right there.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting talking to Blauers every week. You know, he pointed out, I think earlier in the game, how Kelnick was kind of jumping and expecting to hit the wall. And in Houston, and how, you know, they have different varying things, the garage doors and all that stuff. And it was, you know, again, very insightful by Blauers that, like, that's part of a young ball player. You got to get used to these opposing parks, you know. And so maybe that was part of it. He didn't understand the expanse between him and Bowers. So
he's had some gaffes in center field. You can see he's athletic, and he seems like he normally tracks the ball well. But he's had a few moments as of late where you're like, okay, I don't know. He got turned around on that play in center field. He's had a couple moments recently where you're like, okay, I'm not sure what's happening out there. But, again, this is kind of one of those seasons you sort of write off. Like, all right, he's getting all these things under his belt, getting the mistakes out of the way. You kind of live with it now. It's not acceptable next season.
Right.
If he's hitting 150, 160, you're sending him down. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've got 22 games left. You're not going to send him down now, and there's really nobody to replace him either. You need him. So it's just we're watching the growing pains
right.
is what we're doing. But we'll get into more of what they did right now. Let's take two. Are we not doing take two?
No, we're not doing take two. I was like,
I thought we were going to do that.
I didn't know there was a take two.
I thought there was.
Yeah, okay.
It's 420, not 220.
Yeah. Well, I thought it was first segment and sponsor, all that stuff. Okay, anyway.
I was looking for take
all right.
two, but it's not.
Just kidding.
Yeah. Just joking.
Here, let's do that. Take two. So anyway, Marmolejos came.
That's more important than what I have to say.
Yeah. How about Marmolejos? By the way, who I called Toro Molinos the other day.
You combined Toro and him?
Well, no. What it was is that Toro Molinos is a street in Palm Springs.
Oh.
I knew that. I was calling him Toro Molinos. And like, who are you talking about? Marmolejos. He was the one that Shannon was talking to, and he said, His motto is, the past brings me down and the future makes me anxious. And I thought, that's a really great quote for a ball player, especially. I mean, you want to learn from your past, but if you want to dwell on it, you know, just don't dwell on the past. And then, you know, be sort of in the moment.
And the future makes me anxious?
Yeah.
Is what he said? It's a good saying. I like that.
Yeah, I like it too.
Was it in an article or anything? Or were
no, he just said it.
Oh, okay.
He was. Oh, you're talking about with Shannon. I think she probably posted it somewhere.
Huh.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Should have made a big deal of it. I like that. I like that.
It is.
That's good.
It's very good.
He had a huge moment here in the top of the ninth.
And the 1-0 pitch, Jose swinging a ground ball through the wide open left side of the infield. Here comes Moore on to score. Kelnick running third, heading home, and he's going to score. The throw to the plate is cut off by Gonzalez. Holy smokes, Jose Marmolejos with a two-out, two-run single here in the top of the ninth inning. And the Mariners now lead the Astros 6-4.
You hear that one lone voice out there? You hear that guy?
I know the Mariner fans.
What was that? I don't know if that's an angry Astros fan or an excited Mariner fan.
Did you hear the wooing guy the other night?
Well, yeah, terrible. You hear those. But there was just that one. Did you hear that lone voice just yelling? It was just
one good fan.
I don't know if that was a yell of anger or joy. I'm not sure.
I think we're becoming those annoying fans. I like it.
You think it was an obnoxious Mariner fan?
Yeah.
Well, if he was yelling then, he certainly would have yelled when J.P. Crawford stepped up to the plate.
Taylor ready. The stretch delivers. Swing and a fly ball well hit to right field. Tucker going back, looking up, and goodbye baseball, J.P. Crawford. With his seventh home run of the season, a two-out, two-run home run, and the Mariners now lead the Astros 8-4 here in the top half of the ninth.
I didn't hear him there, but that was a great moment. J.P. Crawford coming up with the long ball, and they needed it. Mariners give up a run late in the game, gets a little. And it was Bregman again. That face. And I was just going, you got to be kidding me. They're not going to do this again, are they? They're not going to get the bullpen again, are they? And they didn't. They didn't. So the Mariners get the win, thank goodness, keeping their hopes alive with just a precious few games left. It is dwindling fast, Dave.
You think we'll be looking back on that extra inning game?
I think we're going to look. Night? I personally will be looking at the first two games of that Kansas City series where you had four-run leads in each of those games and you found a way to lose them both.
Didn't you say they stranded 40?
Yes.
Over the series?
Yeah, 40 stranded runners. You lost three of those games. That's one I will absolutely be looking back at. And the game yesterday, listen, I'm not going to jump on Seawald or the bullpen. He's been nails. They've been phenomenal. So if they have a hiccup, okay, I can live with it. Disappointing, but I can live with it. But, yeah, the Kansas City series was – that one hurt. That hurt. All right, coming up, there is one reason Pete Carroll is more optimistic about how his defense will start the season. We'll let you hear what he had to say about it. Coming up next with Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live through the Alaska Airlines studio on the 710 Sports app.
Now, here are your hosts, Dave Wyman and Bob Stelton.
Shake it off, Bob. Shake it off.
All good things come to an end, Dave. Just get back out there. Get back out on the market.
Say it isn't so.
Just get back out. Hey, our conversation with Mike Blowers was always fun. Love talking to Mike Blowers. That'll be coming up at 4:45. We gave you part one yesterday. You'll get part two today. Brady Henderson at 5 o'clock. The professor, John Clayton, will join us at 6 o'clock today. So make sure you stay tuned for all of that. But we talk Seahawks. It is game week. Can you believe it's already game week?
Yeah.
Game one. This is real. This counts.
Right.
This is it.
Yeah, it's weird to think. I mean, we're just getting right into it, man. I mean, we got the huddle tomorrow. Lots of things going on.
So this is where the first loss of the season where they start 0-9, according to computers?
Oh, my gosh.
What kind of fakakta nonsense is that?
I thought you were going to say something. It's like, whoa, Bob, calm down.
In all reality.
Put your finger on the dump button there. That's
not dealing in reality. If you're coming out with that and saying, well, our computer says you're going 0-9 to start the season. I mean, that's nonsensical. That's like, okay, maybe they won't live up to the hype. Maybe they'll disappoint us on some level. But the idea that a team that has the roster they do, whatever you think of it, you've already got the most important piece. A franchise quarterback in his prime is good for win. So the idea that they're not going to be able to scratch out a win in the first nine games of the season is beyond asinine.
Yeah. Okay, there it is. It's Cynthia Freeland. I know. She does like a probability thing of winning on the NFL Network. And I was just typing her name and trying to figure it out. Like, you know, I see sometimes she'll put these things out about, you know, how many yards and stuff like that. And I don't know, you know, like I was saying with Clayton, I'm like, who's feeding the information into the machine?
Mm-hmm.
You know, who's in charge of the input? Because you have a top four quarterback and you have the best receiving duo in the NFL and you have the best safety duo. You know, you're good at almost every position except, you know, corners, the question mark, mm-hmm. you know, this year, maybe center. But, man, they're pretty solid all the way across. I just don't know. I don't know what they're looking at. I mean, I know that the Indianapolis Colts were a good team last year, a playoff team. But, you know, they've got some concerns going in with their quarterback, especially.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you look at their first nine games, you could make an argument. Well, okay, I could see them losing that. I mean, it certainly could happen. But when you look at the last two in the first eight, the New Orleans Saints, who I assume will have Jameis Winston, I don't think they're on the come. I don't think they're improving.
Yeah.
I think this is going to be a step back year for that franchise, followed by Jacksonville. These are both home games.
Yeah.
So they're saying, this computer is saying, the Saints And more importantly, Jacksonville will come to Seattle and beat the Seahawks.
Mm-hmm.
And then they get a bye week, and then it's Green Bay on the road. Okay, if they lose that game, that would make sense. Tough place to play. But just the idea that somehow they're not going to be able to scratch out a win in those first nine is just it's mind-boggling.
Well, and it's funny, you know, how, I don't know, they've sort of been the whipping post here as far as, you know, that's not right. The whipping boy, I should say, that,
yeah.
You know, that for some reason, I don't
You're
know.
You're thinking of the Allman Brothers.
That's right. Tie me up to the whipping post or something. But, yeah, I don't get that. I see. Okay, so and let's just go through the first four. I mean, Tennessee is a very physical team. And, mm-hmm. you know, I keep saying they need to bring back the violence on their yeah. defense, the Seahawks do. And that's going to be a smash-mouth game, a lot because of their coach, but because they got guys like Derrick Henry and just some big studs on their defense. And, you know, so then
they
you
got
go
a
to,
new receiver over there that could be problematic.
Julio, yeah. So, or some people call him Julio. and then at San Francisco, I mean, that's going to be tough, but I just think they're going to be able to be competitive in every game that they play. I mean, I think the most difficult one by far is at Green Bay.
Yeah.
To me, that, you know,
we'll the
see.
First nine?
Yeah. Well, and I'm just saying the entire season. Yeah. I mean, it's always tough with San Francisco, you know, and playing the division rivals, Los Angeles. I still don't really get all the hype over the Rams just because of all the losses they've gotten. But, you know, I think they're putting a lot into Matthew Stafford, but. Yeah, I don't get what kind of information is going in. And then, you know, you look at just the number of guys that didn't play. You didn't see, for some reason it stands out to me, Puna Ford, not a single snap out
right.
of Puna. And they just signed him to a pretty good deal. You know, you didn't see Bobby Wagner. You didn't see
Jamal
Diggs. You didn't see anybody, really.
Yeah, Quandre Diggs didn't play.
Right.
Didn't, I mean,
Dunlap
didn't play. Yeah, the majority of your defense didn't play. Same with the offense. So.
Right.
It's interesting, but you brought up defense, and Pete Carroll, obviously, nobody was happy with how things started last year. First half was an absolute atrocity. It was terrible. It was hard to look at. Defensively, it was unlike anything we'd ever imagined could happen under Pete Carroll. And he's talking about, you know, hey, we need to see consistency from this defense all year.
Really, a couple basics. It would be the consistency, one, and elimination of explosive plays. You know, last year was a really unusual year. We were scoring so much early in games and early, and we got ahead so far that we gave up just an extraordinary amount of yards in fourth quarters. And we gave up 180 or 200 yards in the fourth quarter, and all your numbers look crazy, you know. And we didn't handle that situation well enough. I hope we get ahead again and we can have that same challenge, you know. But the season changed some and we shifted with it and took advantage of it and just got better as we went along. We were giving away easy stuff. You know, we were giving away just catch and run stuff and just weren't as sharp as we needed to be. And when the teams go into that mode and they're in a 2-minute situation for a quarter, they put up a lot of yards. You don't have to do a whole lot to do that. You just keep dinking the ball around and it works. So we have to be better in that situation, but we got to get rid of explosives and we got to be more consistent.
Okay, so yeah, some of it was because they were way ahead. And so, you know, that the offense was so good in the first half.
You're saying they went into like a prevent defense?
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, just don't get beat deep. You know, make them make plays all the way down the field. And that's where you saw a lot of the, you know, the buffoonery that was with the pass coverage. And I just, you know, and it was everybody. I mean, they did. They better not be having the come-to-Jesus meeting at week 8.
Where somebody needs to stand up and hold everybody accountable.
It needs to be after, if it doesn't happen, week 1. You know, because you've got veteran players out there, and you've got guys that know how to play in this defense and great leadership. Great leadership. You know, you look at some of the older guys like Dunlap and Bobby Wagner and Jamal Adams, and he's not older, but, I mean, he's just such a leader and just got so much juice and – you know, so I think it's going to be interesting to me. The defense is really the one that I'm the most, I don't want to say concerned, but I'm excited to see. I want to see them play really physical. I think they need to take a step up in that regard.
To me, they don't have the excuse that the offense may have to begin the season.
That's a good point. Yeah.
I feel like we could see the offense get off to a slow start and sort of explain it away, going, well, listen, these guys got a brand new play caller, brand new system. They're getting used to it. None of them played in the preseason, so it's going to take them a game or two, a week or two to kind of find their rhythm. Defense has no excuse. It's the same coordinator. It's the same defense. I'm sure there's some new wrinkles here and there. But overall, for especially guys that have been in it, there is zero excuse to make mistakes or be looking at each other with palms up going, I thought you were, my job was to do this and weren't you going to be there? No, you don't have any slack on defense.
You know who they are, Bob. They're the Mariners in 2022.
No excuses.
No excuses.
Exactly right. Exactly
yeah.
right.
All right. I totally agree with you. Totally. Yeah. I mean, look, what's changed there, really? You've just added parts, but, I mean, most of these guys, there's not a bunch of rookies out there. You know, yeah, I agree with you.
All right, coming up, part two of our conversation with the great Mike Blowers. It's coming your way next with Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live through the Alaska Airlines studio on the 710 Sports app.
Now, here are your hosts, Dave Wyman and Bob Stelton.
We had a chance to catch up with Mariners color analyst Mike Blowers. We gave you the first part of the conversation yesterday. Part two coming your way next. And we started this part off talking about being plunked because Ty France has been hit, what, 22, 23 times? Some absurd number, just an absurd number of times. So obvious first question in Mike's long career, how many times were you plunked?
Hit by a pitch? Not very often. If I had to guess, I would say, seven, eight times.
In your whole career?
That would be my guess. I have no idea, but I didn't get hit very often.
It's amazing to watch Ty France up there. And we were talking to Ryan Roland-Smith about this, and he was talking about, you know, that you look at his back foot, and it's in the very, you know, close corner next to the ump and the catcher there. And I get that, and I've been really watching him. The idea that this guy's been, is it 22 or 23 times now this season? I can't even keep track of how many times he's been hit.
Yeah, over 20, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he doesn't dive into the ball. When you watch his stride, he's not striding toward first base or even the pitcher a lot of times. He's kind of – I've seen guys that crowd the plate much more, that dive over the plate much more than he does. How do you sort of – and I know he doesn't always, you know, make the biggest effort to get away if it's going to hit him in that arm guard, which is great. But overall, to see a guy hit as often as he's been hit, how do you rationalize – how do you explain that one?
Yeah, I think that there's a couple of things that are involved in that. One, as you mentioned, he's close to the plate. He knows that. I've talked to him about that. He's aware of where he's standing at the plate. He knows where he's at. And he feels, and this is what he told me, he feels that for him to be at his best, he cannot give ground. In other words, if I'm going to stand on this plate, I realize that guys are going to try to pitch me inside, and they're not going to be perfect, and at times I'm going to get hit. But for me to be the best hitter that I can be, I am not going to give ground. And then the last thing that he said to me was that when he was in college, it was kind of like this badge of honor for guys not to get out of the way and to go ahead and get hit and take first base. And that really is a college thing. I mean, that college guys do that all the time. They will get hit. They will not get out of the way. But once you get to the big leagues and you're seeing these guys throwing as hard as they do, a lot of guys will all of a sudden knock that off and get out of the way. But there are hitters, and I'm telling you, I've seen guys before that are just not going to give up any ground at all because they feel like for them to be at their best, they can't do that. So he understands he's going to get hit. I don't think he understood it's going to happen as often as it has with him. And obviously it cost him some games. And maybe that is something that the club might talk to him about when the season is over. But it's an individual thing. And I think because he's close to the plate and his mindset is he's not going to give ground is the reason why he gets hit. And if you watch him, he rarely gets out of the way, like really makes an effort to get out of the way unless it's at his head. So that's about it.
Hey, Mike, just a baseball.
For me, I will say this, with the season he's having and kind of trying to look forward to the hitter that he is going to be moving forward, which I think he'll hit for more power also, it might be a conversation I have with him to let's try to get out of the way if you recognize the pitch is inside off the plate. Because they need him in the lineup, right?
Yes, I mean, they do.
Have him in the lineup. Yeah.
Why don't we go ahead and try to avoid the ball? How about that?
Yeah. Yeah, but again, you have to remember his mentality. He feels like it makes him a better hitter, that he's made up his mind that he's not going to get grounded. And if you watch him, he handles the pitch off the plate away and can hit it that way because of that. He's going to stick his nose in there and he's just not going to budge. So, but there has to be, I think, a happy medium in there where he's not getting hit as much.
Hey, Mike, just a baseball 101 question for you. The other day when Flexen was pitching down in Arizona in that series, I think you were doing the game, and you know, he turned around. I think he took his hat off, and they were in a shift. And I can't remember who the batter was, but he was kind of signaling to his infielders, and they were moving around. Can you kind of tell us what's going on there?
I think sometimes, so you sit, the infield is set before the game even starts, right? So they know you see the outfielders looking at that card. They have a meeting on it on the infield. The infielders know who they're going to shift on. Sometimes they'll change up during the game. I've talked to Scott about this a number of times through the years. And depending on who's on the mound, that may change things. The way that the pitcher decided that he's going to change the way he's going to pitch to a certain hitter, that may change things. Certainly the situation in the game can change it also. I can remember a number of years ago, but Jed Lowry beat them a couple of different times going against the shift. And I was talking to Scott about that. And he goes, yeah, I think we're going to stop doing that with him, especially with runners in scoring position, because he's a veteran guy and he has the ability to hit away from the defense. And so they stopped doing it. Now, when he was hitting with nobody on, they had the shift on. But when there's runners in scoring position, they stopped doing it. So there's adjustments that go on. Probably my guess would be, and I haven't talked to Chris, but my guess would be that he decided he's going to pitch this guy a little bit differently, and maybe he made some adjustments to the defense that way, yeah. Which Scott has also said if the pitcher feels strongly about it, he's okay with him moving those guys around.
Yeah, that's definitely what it looked like, because it was pitch to pitch, I think. So it looked like he was maybe moving them with some hand signals and stuff like that. So interesting.
Yeah, it's happened before. I know for me, you know, there are certain pitchers that I would play behind, and they would move me, you know, same way in between pitches, depending on what they were going to do. And like I figured out real quick when Norm Charlton would come in the game to close the game out, I had to know when he was going to throw his split, because all the right-handed hitters, if they were going to hit it and keep it fair, it was going to be right down the line. And typically at that point, he still threw pretty hard. If it was his fastball, I would cheat more towards the hole. So I had to know which pitch was coming every single time. And I typically would get that from the shortstop. But sometimes even Norm would look at me and just go, I'm just going to go heavy split here, and I'd just stay on the line.
Hey, Mike, you know, it's interesting. I'm looking at the lineup last night and just looking at averages, and I know the average has been devalued with sabermetrics and people don't follow it quite as much, but it's still an indicator as to what a guy is doing throughout a season. Have you sort of devalued it as you've gone on? And when you look at, I mean, because you could be discouraged looking at this lineup. You got four guys hitting under 200. You've got three guys hitting above 250. You know, so you got, you know, Dylan Moore at 172 and Cal Raleigh at 157, Kelnick 158, Marmolejo's 146. You know, Seager obviously really productive, but hitting 212. So when you look at that first blush, you're going, my goodness, what are they running out there? But we've seen them be productive and obviously win a bunch of games. So is that at conflict for you, or have you sort of gone along the way of, yeah, the average is there and it's an indicator, but I don't value it the way I did when I was playing?
I think what the way I look at it, Bob, is I do value it. I think it's still important. I think it's one part of it, though. And I think I have to go by an individual basis. You know, I'm thrilled with the jump that J.P. Crawford has had in his batting average this year, and the way that he's been getting on base and how productive he's been at the top of the order and the way that he's handled left-handers. And the reason why is because he's made some adjustments along the way to improve and be a better player. And you see that right in front of you. And I still don't know what the ceiling is going to be for him. You see that in Ty France, a young hitter, right? Let's just leave that guy alone and let him just go about his business. I think for Kyle Seager, I don't worry about his average at all, because we've talked about it with him. He's hit with runners in scoring position. He's hit with power. And that's all he's trying to do for this team right now. And I think I'm perfectly fine with that. I think with somebody like Haniger, a veteran guy, I think Mitch would probably tell you that he would like to see his average 20 points higher. When you get to the younger guys, the way I look at it is, okay, you know, Marmolejos is another guy. He got off to just a dreadful start this year. He went to AAA, absolutely tore it up. I'll see what he does from this point forward. He's hit a home run. He hit a double the other day. So I don't really worry about his overall average, because he's never going to get that back. But is he productive from now to the end of the season? Then maybe I reevaluate how important he is to our organization, a left-handed hitter with some pop. Kelnick, Raleigh, all these young guys, we talked about it all year. We knew it was going to be tough. They both got off to really tough starts. They're still trying to figure this thing out. And major league pitching and scouting and defenses have taken advantage of all of that. And it's a tough go for those guys. But I think as an organization, you keep pushing these younger guys along, knowing that they're going to struggle. And you just want to see improvement, progress, and most of all, how do they handle it?
He is Mike Blowers with us every single week here with Wyman and Bob talking baseball. We love it. You guys love it. And we look forward to next week. Mike, thanks so much, man.
Okay, guys. Talk to you next week. Thanks.
There you go. There's Mike Blowers. Great to catch up with him every single week. Meanwhile, what are the Seahawks expecting out of this Colts team? Brady Henderson of ESPN.com will join us next to break it all down. It's coming your way with Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.